From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who has visited North Korea twice this year, said on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday, the U.S. is prepared to provide security assurances for Pyongyang if it agrees to complete verifiable denuclearization.
Look, we'll have to see how the negotiations proceed, but make no mistake about it. America's interest here is preventing the risk that North Korea will launch a nuclear weapon into L.A. or Denver or into the very place we're sitting here this morning. That's our objective. That's the end state the president has laid out. And that's the mission that he sent me on this past week, to put us on the trajectory to go achieve that.
Pompeo, in a separate appearance on Fox News Sunday, said success could mean lifting of sanctions, allowing private American investment to flow into North Korea and build up its infrastructure.
We can create conditions for real economic prosperity for the North Korean people that will rival that of the South. And that is our expectation. It won't be U.S. taxpayers. It will be American know-how, knowledge, entrepreneurs, and risk-takers working alongside the North Korean people to create a robust economy.
On the ABC program this week, National Security Advisor John Bolton said President Donald Trump has indicated human rights will be part of his conversation with leader Kim Jong-un June 12 in Singapore.
Well, I think he's certainly going to raise the question of the Japanese abductees. Prime Minister Abe of Japan asked him to do it. He said he would. The South Koreans are very concerned about South Korean citizens who have been kidnapped over the years. It's a proper subject to raise.
North Korean state media reports Pyongyang will dismantle its nuclear bomb site later this month. Medical teams from the UN and Democratic Republic of Congo are deploying to Northwest DRC, where a new outbreak of Ebola has claimed at least 18 lives. There are more than 30 confirmed cases of the deadly virus. Thousands of doses of experimental Ebola vaccine are on hand. This is VOA News. The U.S. suggested Europeans doing business with Iran could face sanctions after President Donald Trump's decision last week to pull out of the nuclear agreement with Iran, known as JCPOA. Once again, National Security Advisor Bolton.
I think the president said in his statement on Tuesday that countries that continue to deal with Iran could face U.S. sanctions. Europeans are going to face the effect of U.S. sanctions, already are, really, because much of what they'd like to sell to Iran involves U.S. technology for which the licenses will not be available.
On the CBS program Face the Nation, Secretary of State Pompeo said the U.S. hopes to be able to achieve a wider agreement with Europeans about U.S. concerns over Iranian behavior.
President Trump and President Macron have both said we want to get a deal that's right, a bigger deal. We will be hard at that in the weeks ahead. I hope to be a central part of achieving that. It would be a wonderful thing if we could get the Europeans to do this.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is visiting each of the capitals of the other signatories to the deal to see if it can be salvaged. China, France, Russia, Britain, and Germany have joined Tehran in remaining in the accord for now. Israel is celebrating 70 years since its founding, May 14, 1948. On Sunday, they observed the relocation of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The embassy is due to open Monday. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians are converging on Israel's frontier with Gaza, a day they call Nakba, or Catastrophe, the day that Israel was founded. French police continue the investigation into a Chechnya-born French citizen's attack on a man with a knife late Saturday in the Opera District of Paris. The man died. Four others, including one each from China and Luxembourg, were wounded. The attacker was killed by police. In Indonesia's second biggest city, Surabaya, police headquarters was the apparent target Monday of two militants on a motorbike who blew themselves up, with one report of several police casualties. The attack came a day after a family of six launched separate suicide attacks on three churches in Surabaya, killing at least 13 and wounding more than 40.
Tindakan terorisme kali ini sungguh.
President Joko Widodo visited the scenes of the attack and denounced them as barbaric and beyond the limit of humanity. Police have blamed the attacks on an Islamic State-inspired group called JAD. At least five Pakistani students were killed, 12 others missing Sunday, after a bridge collapsed at a tourist site in Pakistan, Kashmir. The bridge, which overlooks a ravine in the mountainous Neelam district, gave way after dozens of students walked across to view a waterfall. In Afghanistan, at least 10 were killed, dozens wounded, when militants detonated bombs and stormed a government building in the eastern city Jalalabad Sunday. Islamic State claimed responsibility. All eight assailants were killed by security forces after a battle lasting hours. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, May 14th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Burundians demand accountability for the killings over the weekend of 26 people in the country's northwest province.
Our preliminary view is that those instruments were not adequately used in order to protect the population in that particular area. We are still investigating in order to understand why and also who should have done what.
Jean-Baptiste Baribog Nakaza is chair of the Independent Human Rights Commission of Burundi. A faction of Zimbabwe's opposition MDC announces its manifesto ahead of presidential election. Kenya launches a home design satellite, and Liberia's Nobel Peace Laureate Lema Bowie lends her support to the call for the establishment of an economic and war crimes court.
You and I sitting here, even losing a family member by natural causes is painful, let alone someone's life being snipped out of them by the barrel of a gun. So every call for war crimes court is legitimate and people need to pay attention to it.
Gambia over the weekend held its first mayoral elections since the end of Yahya Jammeh's regime, and Dakar's Biennale is in full force this month. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's Independent Human Rights Commission has accused local authorities of negligence after armed men killed 26 people and wounded dozens more in the country's Cibitoke province. As Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, the killings come almost a week before Burundi's controversial constitutional referendum, which starts this Thursday.
Selvan Ngakondi Bukore is the mother of four children, now mourning for her two brothers-in-law killed in the attack in Ruhagarika village, located in Cibitoke province in the northwestern part of the country. According to the Burundian authority, 14 of the 26 people who were killed and burned were children. Selvan explains how it happened. She says that it was her brother-in-law that was killed together with his wife and a child, and that they didn't stop from there, but proceeded to another home of another brother-in-law and killed both the man and the wife. The attack comes a few days before the country holds a referendum for the first time since 2005, when the incumbent president took over the office. This has raised fears and concerns within the citizens amid growing uncertainty of the peace and stability in the country. The National Independent Human Rights Commission blamed local authorities of negligence for failing to protect citizens. Jean-Baptiste Baribonekeza is the chairman of the Independent Human Rights Commission.
Our preliminary view is that those instruments were not adequately used in order to protect the population in that particular area. We are still investigating in order to understand why and also who should have done what. We are of the strong view that evidently the local authorities, we think, obviously done better in order to protect the population.
Burundi government announced that the funeral of the victims will be conducted tomorrow. The Burundi Public Security Minister, Alain Guillaume Bunyoni, said that security forces will not sit back and watch citizens being brutally killed. He said that those who made the attack should not celebrate, and that Burundi is already cooperating with the Democratic Republic of Congo in order to stop that terrorist group. No specific group had come out to claim the attack. However, the Burundi Human Rights Commission said that armed group infiltrated from Congo, and after killing civilians, they were able to cross again the border. The attack is considered to be the worst in 2 years. At least 5 million Burundians are expected to vote for or against the amendment of the country's constitution, which critics say is aimed to pave way for the incumbent president to rule the country until 2034. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Presidential politics appear to be taking shape in Zimbabwe ahead of this year's elections. President Emmerson Mnangagwa of the ruling ZANU-PF and Nelson Chamisa of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, faction have begun to position themselves as front runners. Chamisa also appears to be quoting officials of the newly formed National Patriotic Front Party. On Saturday, another faction of the MDC, led by Toko Zani-Kupe, launched its campaign along with its election manifesto, promising to build an economy to support transformation. Nixon Nyikazino is Secretary General of the Kupe-led faction of the MDC. He says the most important aspect of the manifesto is its focus on the poor in terms of social service delivery.
Our manifesto is titled Building an Economy to Support Transformation for People's Livelihoods. That manifesto, I can assure you, is premised on two fronts. One is the respect of our ideology of the social democratic principles, while at the same time it's anchored on revitalization of the economy in order to uplift our people, the majority of whom are in extreme poverty. But the most critical issue is how we are focusing on the poor people of Zimbabwe in terms of social service delivery.
Let me say that the Zimbabwe economy suffered tremendously under President Robert Mugabe. What exactly would you do about creating jobs?
What we are looking at is to seek as much investment as possible and, mobilize resources to ensure that we actually reindustrialize, because we know that in the past 37 years under Robert Mugabe's rule, our industry has been dilapidated, our infrastructure has been dilapidated. So a recapitalization of our industry in terms of the mining and in terms of our manufacturing industry will ensure that we have exports that can bring in new money into Zimbabwe. And once you have re-industrialized and you have recapitalized your manufacturing industries, it means you are creating jobs.
With this party manifesto, it is now obvious that the MDCT wing of Ms. Kupe is going it alone, and the Chamisa wing is going it alone. The fear many people have is that this split may probably give the victory to President Mnangagwa and the ZANU-PF.
James, you should understand that when we left the Chamisa-led cabal, it was based on the principle of constitutionalism, because Nelson Chamisa failed to respect the constitution of the party. So our MDCT is premised on the founding principles and values of the party when it was founded in 1999.
I was reading the political developments from Zimbabwe over the weekend, and I read that Nelson Chamisa seemed to be quoting officials from the newly formed political party that is supported by former President Mugabe. Does that concern you?
It does not concern us on the basis that if they are quoting the National Patriotic Front, they are quoting the same people who have been part and parcel of running down this country.
Nixon Nyikazino is the Secretary General of the Toko Zani-Kupe-led faction of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. Kenya last Friday joined the list of African nations with an eye on space when it launched a home-designed satellite. Economic analyst Ali Khan Sachu says the new mini-satellite will impact the Kenyan economy in a positive way. Reporter Maureen Ojiambo spoke with Mr. Khan and filed this report from Nairobi.
The satellite was designed by Kenyan scientists at the University of Nairobi. It is part of the joint program between the United Nations and Japanese Space Agency to support research institutions from developing countries. It was deployed to orbit the Earth from the International Space Station's ISS at the university. In an exclusive interview with VOA's Daybreak Africa, economist Ali Khan Sachu says the new satellite will have a positive economic impact.
Clearly, that there is a lot of value in collecting this data, in particular around our agricultural economy. If you can predict the weather better, you can see what the problems we've had recently. So I think there is a legitimate return on investment of putting up a satellite in the sky.
He says the money the Ministry of Education will use next financial year is manageable, and that the satellite will be funded by Kenya and the government of Japan. Mr. Sacho says Kenya should embrace the Japanese support in order to grow technology-wise.
I suspect that they're going to get assistance with respect to that particular budget. I know the Japanese, for example, have been very supportive. So I don't think that will end up being a budget item that we've got to pay for in full. It's a strong, powerful statement for Kenya and for Japan. And I'm sure there's an opportunity for skills transfer to happen in what is now a much more commoditized business.
Education Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed, who was present during the launch of the satellite, says the project is one of the biggest steps that Kenya could make in nanotechnology.
This is the first satellite that we have deployed today. It's a cube. I think for the moment, what we expect would be information that would be coming in that would not be as accurate and as clear as the information that we expect to get after we have a constellation of satellites.
Kenya joins the list of 12 countries that have launched home-designed satellites, including South Africa, Egypt, Nigeria, Algeria, and Morocco. The African Union last year passed an African space policy to use satellite communications for economic progress. The mini satellite has potential of conducting commercial space missions such as disaster management, earth mapping, earth observation, land use and environmental monitoring, weather forecasting, communication, coastline and border monitoring, management of forest, livestock and wildlife that previously required large satellites. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 14th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Liberia's Nobel laureate Lema Mbowe has given her support to the call for the establishment of an economic and war crimes court. Mbowe, who won the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize along with President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, says any call for a war crimes court is a legitimate one and must be taken seriously. Mbowe wants serve as head of President Sirleaf's Peace and Reconciliation Commission, but resigned, saying the president was not committed to reconciliation. She says what Liberia needs now is a leader with the political will to bring about genuine reconciliation. Mbowe says the relationship between she and former President Sirleaf is like matches and kerosene. Mbowe was the commencement speaker over the weekend at the American University School of International Service. She tells me Liberians should view peace from a holistic perspective.
I think when people begin to look at peace as the end of war, then we miss the mark. We need to begin to look at peace from the whole human security perspective. Peace is about people having their basic needs, educational opportunities, healthcare, food, just moving people from one state to the other.
You serve on President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's Commission for Peace and Reconciliation, but you did resign, saying that you didn't think that she was that committed. At the end of her term, she said that her administration did not do much in bringing about reconciliation in Liberia. Do you feel vindicated, the fact that she said this, and how do you think reconciliation and peace can come about in Liberia?
Well, vindication will mean gloating, and I'm not one person that gloats about where Liberia finds herself. I was sad that we have to have spent 12 wasted years. President Sirleaf's administration had the opportunity to bring Liberians to a place of beginning, not ending, beginning that journey of reconciliation, and she failed. Today, I think what we need from every corner of Liberia is a political leader, our president, or any future president. Now we have a new president starting the whole process of reconciliation. Because whilst the people may be ripe and ready for reconciliation, if there is no political will, we can never get to reconciliation. And that was the problem we had with the Ellen-led administration. That lack of political will just killed the process before it even started.
What, do you think there's a political will in this new administration? Because some people are now saying perhaps maybe Liberia is not ready for that yet.
Well, I think every country, after going through 14 years of crisis, is ready for reconciliation. But the question we need to ask ourselves, what aspects of reconciliation? So you have people who are saying war crimes courts. You have people who are saying, okay, let's start at the community level. You have people who are saying there has never been a process of national apology by any leader since the war ended.
Do you support the call for a war crimes court?
Well, James, I can tell you one thing. There's no way we can overlook people's quest for justice. It is a legitimate quest. You and I sitting here, even losing a family member by natural causes is painful, let alone someone's life being snuffed out of them by the barrel of a gun. So every call for war crimes court is legitimate and people need to pay attention to it.
What's your relationship with your co-recipient of this Nobel Peace Prize, President Sirleaf? What is the relationship now?
Well, President Sirleaf was president of Liberia. I was an activist. She's a politician. I'm an activist. I'm a feminist. She said outrightly in one Guardian interview that she's not a feminist. I've always said to people, when a politician and activist come together, it's almost like matches and kerosene. So we do not have a relationship. I haven't spoken to her in a long time. But besides, James, President Sirleaf is like my grandmother. I don't intend for her to be my friend on that level. I know we are supposed to be cordial to one another, and yes, I'm cordial to her. I give her all of the respect, not because we disagree on policies that I won't respect her. I give her all of the respect, but at the end of the day, you don't expect me to be having tea at President Sirleaf's house, and I don't expect for her to be coming to my birthday party. We're not age mates.
Le Magbowi of Liberia was the co-recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. She was speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. Gambians over the weekend voted in their first mayoral elections throughout the country since President Yahya Jammeh's government came to an end in December 2016. Mr. Jammeh's former ruling APRC party has not done well in elections since his departure. As VOA's Pandere Umbaya reports, Usainu Dabo's United Democratic Party, the UDP, captured almost all the mayoral seats in Saturday's election.
The United Democratic Party, Gambia's biggest political party, swept the mayoral elections over the weekend. Out of the 8 contested administrative regions in the Gambia, the UDP won 7 seats, while the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress Party, GDC, won 1 seat. Aliou Mamar Njai is the chairman of Gambia's Independent Electoral Commission.
Prior to law has been duly elected mayoress of Banyo City Council. This is 12 May 2018, signed Aliou Mamar Njai. Well, so far, this is what we got, and we are waiting for the others to come. Thank you very much.
Rohi Law is Gambia's first elected female mayoress. She contested on the UDP ticket and won a slim margin. Overall, the opposition and the independent votes combined nationwide. The UDP has been outperformed. But political observers said, due to lack of formidable merger among the vying candidates, the UDP was able to win big. Dr. Ismaila Cisse is a political science professor at the University of the Gambia. Dr. Cisse told iAfrica TV that he was not surprised by the outcome of the electoral results.
Anybody who understands Gambian politics and observes well, you'll realize that UDP would win, especially in KMC, not because they are very, very popular, but because the votes are fragmented.
Indeed, the votes were fragmented, and that was to UDP's advantage. Dr. Cisse notes that having a 50% electoral voting system will further enrich Gambia's democracy. He says under such voting system, candidates cannot be declared winner unless they poll 50% of the total vote cast. Tali Bensuda is Gambia's youngest elected mayor for the Kanifing municipality.
I tell all the voters that participated in this election, today we are all winners in this democratic process. We have proven that the fundamentals of our democracy are sound.
That was Pandere Umbaya reporting. Dakar's Biennale is in full force this month, with more than 75 artists from more than 33 countries exhibiting. Shows are set up throughout the Senegalese capital, and this year's theme is Liberation and Emancipation. One show that draws upon the idea is Raw Material Company's exhibit, examining the May 1968 student strikes at the University of Dakar. This year's Biennale falls on the 50th anniversary of the important event in Senegal's history.
The history of what happened here, despite the long-term consequences that it had on culture and politics, were kind of misunderstood. There seemed to be this crisis of memory around it. And the issues that students were facing in 1968 haven't really changed very much. And what we see is that 1968 and the protests, the student protests of 1968, were the beginning of a cycle that continues until this day, where the university grows, but it doesn't have the resources to support its growth. And so the students are working in ever more dangerous problematic conditions. And so it really seemed important to draw attention to the aesthetics of revolution. You know, we have protests still at the university. Every year we risk having another Année Blanche or last year. And so it struck us as the right moment to really to delve back into the imaginary of 1968, of the protests, and to understand what came out of it.
How does art and culture play a role in both the protests of 1968 and what's going on now?
This was the question that we began with, is what was the role of art and culture in the May 1968 protests? And what we discovered is that it really was quite a spontaneous strike. There wasn't a huge amount of cultural production around the strikes themselves. So what we see with May 1968 is that there was a sort of growing underlying mistrust of the culture that was presented by Leopold Sédar Senghor.
That was Dulce Abraham's Atlas, curator at Raw Materials. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with Egyptian international and African Player of the Year, Mohamed Salah, who was named the English Premier League Player of the Year on Sunday. Mohamed Salah had already won the PFA Player of the Year, voted for by his fellow players, as well as the Football Writers Association Footballer of the Year Award and Liverpool's own Player of the Year prize. The 25-year-old's deluge of individual honours came at the end of the season game, in which he scored a record-breaking 37. Second goal of the Premier League season on Sunday, as the Liverpool forward set a new mark for the most goals scored in the 38-game campaign. He has scored 44 goals in 51 games in all competitions for Liverpool this term. His coach Jurgen Klopp was full of praises for the Egyptian international.
He has played this season, which is outstanding, but he's young enough and has enough potential to improve. So that's really good news for all of us, for him as well. So there's still work to do, and I'm really happy about that. But what he is in his mind, he's a real go-getter. That's cool. He wants to. And I'll mix it up in a few moments, then there will be goals again.
Elsewhere, English Championship side Hull City on Sunday beat Kenya's national soccer champions Gor Mahia 4-3 in penalty shootout to lift the Sportpesa title. The clash at the Nairobi's Kasarani Stadium ended 0-0 in regulation time. Both sides squandered several scoring chances, with the Kenyans taking the lion's share. Nigel Atkins is Hull City coach.
You know, the penalty gods were on our side today. We've got, and well, anyone can win a penalty shootout, as we all know. Today we had a little bit of fortune. Another day we could have gone to the home side.
For Dylan Kerr, the Gor Mahia's coach, he was disappointed, and here's why.
I'm just disappointed for the players that weren't allowed to play today. I mean, it's pathetic. I mean, the match commissioner, I had permission from Hull City to play the whole team. For some weird reason, they said it's a FIFA match. I mean, it's a disgrace.
We stay in Kenya, as Football Kenya Federation President Nick Mwenda has confirmed that Morocco has asked Kenya to support its bid for the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Morocco will take on the joint USA-Canada-Mexico bid during the FIFA Congress in Russia next month, and is hoping Kenya will back their bid amidst threats from the US.
They have asked us for their vote. The Americans are no World Cup. And so for me, I'd say, why not have it in Africa?
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, May 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very productive week.
Hello, I'm Lina Ormudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss addressing neonatal sepsis, a bacterial infection in the bloodstream of newborn babies. For your questions or comments, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.